Welcome to our interview with Nick Walker on somatic psychotherapy. I'm your host, Dr. Ofer Zur, the director of the Zur Institute, which provide over 130 online courses for psychologists, social workers, counselors, nurses, and other mental health professionals. This exciting interview will be featured in the Zur Institute online course on somatic therapy developed by Nick Walker. A few words about Nick. Nick received his master's degree in somatic psychotherapy from the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, in San Francisco, where he's now an adjunct professor in the Interdisciplinary Studies Program. He teaches courses and workshops on applying the principles of somatic psychology to fields such as conflict resolution, diversity work, transformative learning, and creativity. Nick holds a sixth degree black belt in martial arts of Aikido, which he has taught and practiced for over 30 years. Actually, this is where I met Nick first time. He was an instructor of my daughter, and I was sure was impressed at the time. His interest in transformative power of somatic work originated with his observation of the personal transformation people experience through Aikido practice. Nick also teaches, writes, and consults on autism and neurodiversity, and he is the author of our own course at the Zur Institute on autism and neurodiversity course. Welcome to our program, Nick. It's nice to interview you again, and this time on the equally interesting topic of somatic psychotherapy.
Yeah, thank you for having me here again.
Okay, so let's kind of just dive in.
Okay.
A good place to start is for you to tell us, what is somatic psychology, somatic psychotherapy, and what are the basic premises of this field?
So somatic psychology, somatic means working with the body, with the soma. So you have the idea of D.W. Winnicott used to talk about the psyche soma, the whole person as being the psyche as embodied in the soma and the living tissue of the body. And so somatic psychology is psychology and psychotherapy without mind-body dualism. So the idea that the mind is not something that is separate from the body. The body's more than just a taxi for the moving the brain around. That the psyche is organized somatically. So anything, any patterns, for instance, within the psyche, complexes and neuroses and places where the psyche is stuck, and also capacities of the psyche, all of these things you'll find actually in how the body is organized. If there's a blockage in the psyche, a stuck pattern, you'll find that somewhere in the body as physical tension as well.
Needless to say, this will be applied to issues like depression and anxiety as well.
Oh yes, I've every issue. I've yet to find any psychological issue where you don't see it. In anxiety, there's it's right there in the body with the autonomic nervous system getting agitated and the breathing being affected. And so in somatic psychology and somatic psychotherapy, what we have is this idea that because the psyche is organized somatically, there's this relationship of mutual effect, mutual causality between mind and body. There's not a clear boundary, and that provides us with more starting places. So you can work with more conventional talk therapy methods, and that will have a physical effect. If you can talk someone through their difficulties, you'll see them, get more relaxed as they gain insight. But more importantly, you can work through the body. If you're running into if you're running into a stuck point in someone's therapy, you can work through the body on it and say, well, where is this happening in the body? If I, you know, maybe make a shift in the breathing, get them to relax a bodily tension, and that will make them more open to psychological change.
And I can imagine that some people who may be more drawn to the cognitive entry point, changing cognitions, which will, as you say, change their hormonal levels and change their breathing and change their bodily, to have a somatic response. And some people may respond more to a somatic kind of entry point. Again, they're not mutually exclusive, but
exactly.
So you find that different people are different in this way?
Yeah, yeah. We have more entry points. When we bring somatics into it, when we bring the body into it, we're looking at more of the person and more of how the person is organized, and that gives us more tools and more potential entry points. So the techniques of somatic psychology, once you accept this idea that the psyche is somatically organized, that the organization of the psyche is the organization of the body, suddenly you have access to more dimensions of the person. And this is very important, of course, with because there's a lot of things where there's a lot of situations, you know, in psychotherapy, I mean, where there are things that are very easily approached through the body that are difficult to approach just through talk. Sometimes it's a very slow, difficult process to change something through talk. Trauma especially, and trauma, I think, is where somatic psychology really excels, because I think it's, you know, that's where it's been strongest, because with trauma, you know, a person is convinced on a very deep, unconscious, biological level that they're in grave danger. They're going to die. They're going to be destroyed. You know, so you deal with post-traumatic stress.
And we have all this research to talk about that indeed the traumatic experiences are registered and stored in the body and in the brain. So this is really, there's a lot of support in recent brain research to what you just actually stated.
Oh, absolutely. And you talk to, so you can talk to someone who's suffering from post-traumatic stress, and you can get them to understand and agree that, you know, they're not in any danger anymore, and it's safe to relax, and there's no need to have nightmares or flashbacks or anxiety attacks. But it doesn't matter what you convince them of. If something triggers that trauma, their body is telling them that they're in great danger. And so when you start working with the body and getting the body to relax or to feel safe, shifting the breathing patterns, suddenly you're really addressing where the problem is locked in. You're unlocking
it. You know, from my own experience, I was wounded in the 73 war, and while I didn't suffer from PTSD as in the DSM, it was definitely a very powerful and traumatic experience. And then I spent years in psychotherapy and writing about my experience and teaching all over the world, all the way to Moscow, about psychology of war. And it was really intense cognitive, intellectual processing, emotional too, of the traumatic, powerful event of being wounded in battle. But I remember putting a helmet on of virtual reality in San Francisco 20 years after my injury, and I freaked out and jumped under the kind of the table, because my body just responded to the traumatic experience. And 5-6 years later, another virtual experience threw me back as if it was just happening to me. My body just stored this information that you just described, regardless of the intense emotional, cognitive, behavioral, intellectual processing that I invested almost a career in that, but my body just stayed there. And what you are saying, what was missing for me in this healing process was a somatic experience. Right. Do I get it right?
Yes. And when you think about it, is there any psychological difficulty? I mean, except if someone's born maybe with, you know, a predisposition to schizophrenia or something, that might be different. But if in general, if you look at, you know, things that, you know, the DSM calls, you know, personality disorders, anything like that, all of that seems to trace back to trauma of some kind. You know, any difficulty that someone comes into psychotherapy with, there's some kind of trauma. So maybe it's not PTSD, but something has, you know, in their history affected their psyche, and it's done that. It's also in doing that, it's affected the organism. It's affected how they organize their body.
And it ties to genetic or to a lot of other factors. But before we kind of go into more details, perhaps on the big picture, perhaps you can help us map for us what are some of the major approaches to somatic psychotherapy. Perhaps you can even ground us with some names of leaders that associated with this different approach. So give us kind of, I know this course will cover many of these major approaches, and future courses will even take a dive into other aspect of somatic psychotherapy. Oh, yes. Map us for us kind of the major approaches and the names that people can kind of associate with these approaches.
Sure. Well, somatics in modern Western psychotherapy traces back to Wilhelm Reich, who was a disciple of Freud's, and one of the many people who was sort of Freud's being groomed as Freud's heir and Freud's rising star, who then had a giant falling out with Freud.
I know he kicked him out because he was talking about the body, and Freud didn't hear about things like that. He didn't know he had a body.
Right, right. You can really see that. You can see that in pictures of Freud, you know.
Yeah.
Jung had that same problem with Freud, that same split, you know. So Reich was young and brilliant and very aware of the body, and he was working off Freud's idea about sexual repression, but he was seeing this repression happen in the body in the form of chronic tension and numbness. So when he was working with his clients especially on issues around sexuality, he was saying, well, the way to approach these blockages, this numbness, the sense of disconnection or repression or anxiety is release the tensions in the body. And so he developed all these exercises that actually, when you look at them, really resemble a lot of, you know, ancient yoga exercises, ancient tantric yoga exercises, and how he got people breathing, doing these very intense breathing exercises, and rhythmically tensing and relaxing different parts of the body to restore this organic pulsation and organic flow of energy through the body. And so he was a big influence, and then there were also people coming in from movement backgrounds, people coming in from massage and movement, who were a big influence on somatics, who maybe didn't have psychotherapy training, but their work got integrated into psychotherapy later on. Marion Rosen, who developed the Rosen Method, which is a very hands-on, almost massage-like thing, or movement forms like authentic movement.
Mm-hmm.
That Janet Adler did a lot of development of. So all of that kind of came together. One of Reich's students was Alexander Lowen, who did develop Reich's work further into something called bioenergetics. Again, about opening up energy flow in the human organism. And right now, there's a lot of different branches, and the people who are practicing somatic psychotherapists rarely are complete specialists in one form. It really becomes very eclectic, drawing on a lot of forms. So I know a lot of somatic therapists who have, they have training in movement work, authentic movement and that sort of thing. And they have training in, you know, Reich's theories and then in various forms. A lot of good trauma stuff is developing now because, unfortunately, trauma is a growth industry.
You know, yeah.
All these returning war vets and these wars that never seem to end, and even just, you know, urban life is traumatizing. So there's a lot of call for that, and a lot of things that started out being work specifically aimed at trauma that's been integrated into the general field. So Pat Ogden has something called sensory motor psychotherapy. That's one of my favorite ways of working with trauma. Peter Levine's work is called somatic experiencing, and that's another one that really works with the autonomic nervous system, with trauma and anxiety. He has some very interesting stuff. I think in the future we'll do a course on somatics and trauma and definitely feature a lot of Peter's work and Pat Ogden's work.
I'm really pleased. I've worked with Peter's organization. I'm still working with them and find them so hearty and so sincere. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really pleased to hear that. What other kind of names and kind of titles of branches that the listener may want to be aware of?
Eugene Gendland has this work called Focusing, which is not so much about, it's very subtle. It's not so much about dramatic alterations and moving or breathing as anything as just awareness.
But it's awareness of the body.
Body awareness, yes. It's deep mindfulness of the body and just that act of mindfulness. I mean, anyone who's done you know, Zen meditation, for instance, where you're watching your breathing, knows that if you just start watching some function of the body, that has an effect on it.
So if we move forward, it seems like one of the major applications of somatic therapy will be around trauma. And that's really becoming, in the 21st century, with brain scans and the focus on trauma, become really a huge, as you say, growth industry. By the way, I have my own little critique about kind of how therapists often see trauma too much everywhere. September 11, people who watched it on television got traumatized. No, they don't deserve a PTSD diagnosis.
Right.
They were not, their life were not in danger. So we psychotherapists and psychologists and counselors and psychiatrists tend to abuse the diagnosis and kind of see trauma. And me, whether it's my parents from the Holocaust or my grandparents died in the Holocaust and my own war experiences or traveling through Africa, I think I know the difference between trauma and trauma. But this Western soft culture broadens the idea of what is traumatic to a really obscene kind of over-diagnosing.
Yeah, I agree that a lot, you know, many diagnoses are abused. Things are overdiagnosed. You know, post-traumatic stress disorder is maybe overdiagnosed. And at the same time, we're looking at, with somatics, we look a lot at things that are maybe, they're not PTSD, but they're trauma in childhood trauma, especially. It's not PTSD, but there are, you know, people's bodies are shaped partly in childhood, the growth of their bodies and the muscular tensions, how they hold themselves, how they limit themselves, is shaped by what does or doesn't seem safe in their environment. And so that can happen if there's, you know, you can see really extreme things if there's abuse or danger in a childhood environment, but sometimes it's as simple as what is discouraged in the environment or what is not nurtured in a child. I don't know that it's exactly trauma, but the development, the body responds to the developmental environment and people develop different capacities. So there are families, for instance, where it's made it very clear to children from a very early age that displays of exuberance and excitement are not welcome.
And this is registered subjectively in the body, regardless of the DSM diagnosis. And this is what you can detect as well as attend to somatically, regardless of whether it's kind of come to the level of PTSD or not. It's not really, it doesn't matter. What matters is what's a healing process.
Exactly. So for instance, in my own work, I don't conduct psychotherapy. I conduct a lot of coaching with people based on principles of somatic psychology and somatic psychotherapy. And so I work with people, for instance, about how they deal with conflict. And there are people who cannot stand up for themselves and assert themselves because they were harshly smacked down as children for trying to assert themselves or made to feel very guilty for trying to assert themselves. And so I'm training them actually, not by giving them pep talks, but actually training them in what do you do with your body to assert yourself. And there's a whole sort of range of bodily styles and the ways of holding themselves that aren't available to them. They have chronic muscle tension that restricts them from, you know, standing up straight, standing firmly, standing the ground in a very literal sense. And so I have to teach them how to do that with their bodies. Same thing. I do a lot of work also coaching people with creativity, and it's the same thing. People's childhood creativity is discouraged. If a child is over-criticized, they start holding in their creative impulses with chronic tension. And so I work with forms like authentic movement. I do a lot of physical theater work and things like that where I get people moving their body in new ways, and it starts opening up the capacity for creativity and spontaneity again.
That's beautiful. And what are some of the controversy around somatic psychology? It has been around since Freud time.
Oh, yes.
A traditional healing, whether it's Native Americans or Chinese, had recognized it for thousands of years.
Oh, yeah.
So kind of relatively not that new, but relatively new to Western psychology. What are some of the obstacles of this kind of things that makes perfect sense that stop most therapists don't even go through a graduate school course in somatic therapy? Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the obstacles? So what are some of the controversies around somatic development, acceptance, and recognition of somatic psychotherapy and somatic psychology?
Well, I think the primary obstacle, all of the obstacles in a way center around the fact that as a culture, Westerners have this deep mind-body split that's been built into the culture since Descartes and this Cartesian dualism of mind and body. And on also contributing to that, of course, is the religious background of the culture, that the Judeo-Christian faiths are deeply suspicious of the body, as there's a cultural tradition, and even for those of us who don't buy into that anymore, there's such a long-standing tradition built into the culture that the body is sinful in some way. The body's desires will lead you astray. And so there's this very deep split from the body and suspicion of the body.
Or to say it kind of in some regard, to say it more crudely or more precisely in some regard, mm-hmm. that the Western culture sexualize the body and definitely sexualize touch.
And then fear sexuality.
Again, we live in a Western culture which is highly pornographic. I'm on my way to LA, and the billboards there are the most pornographic things that you can is that highly pornographic, but on the other hand, we are also highly phobic. So it's kind of we live in a culture that's split, as you mentioned, and of course, as a forensic psychologist, I see I often encounter experts who just talk about the touch and sexuality are the same in their minds, which is kind of so obscene in some ways. But I think that the split and the sexualizing of the body and the touch are indeed the split of the body mind and the sexualizing of almost all forms of touch.
Yes, I think that there's these are manifestations of the split where the body mm-hmm. is objectified. It's made into an object. So mm-hmm. We talk about my body as if we're talking about my car or my computer, that it's this object that's separate mm-hmm. rather than who we are. And so that that objectification leads to its most obvious, you know, I mean, in a way, the fear of the body is an objectification of the body, and so is pornography. Also, that's an objectification of the body, making the body an object instead of a person. And at the same time, you see it even in athletics, you know. I mean, I'm always surprised when I get, you know, because I, in my work, when I'm teaching people, whether I'm teaching them Aikido or teaching about somatics and creativity, I'm teaching people to feel their bodies more deeply. And it's what surprises me is that athletes often are terribly cut off from their bodies. They've been taught to regard their bodies as
a machine.
As machines. And
it's high performance machine, yeah.
Right, right.
That can take abuse without pain and, mm-hmm. and can do things that kind of beyond the limits, kind of push this machine to its max.
Mm-hmm. And we see this, you know, I mean, look at, you know, I mean, Michael Jackson's death from, you know, his body was so horribly abused. If you watch him dance, he's so, so graceful, but he abused his body terribly, you know, doing pills to keep him from feeling the damage that he was doing to his body by not resting. You know, it's mm-hmm. really this objectification that happens everywhere. And so, yeah, that's built into the sexuality of the culture, too. The body is an object of fear and also an object of desire, but not something that people actually inhabit and love and feel deeply. And I think that being felt deeply is the primary need of the human body.
And as this the courses you're developing for the Zur Institute will be one of the major audience for that are licensed psychotherapists.
Right.
There is a myth in the field of psychotherapy that touch is not part of the standard of care.
Right.
And of course, many codes of ethics don't even use the word touch, but when you listen to ethicists who teach risk management or the people who believe in the faulty notion of the slippery slope, many graduate school students went through training, so-called ethical courses, that tells them that touch is not within the standard of care, which is wrong, which is not true, but nevertheless, sadly so, is highly prevalent. So mm-hmm. What we are talking today about is really a somatic psychology, which is as legitimate as psychoanalysis, and in fact probably has more clinical and empirical support than psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis is primarily based on in individual case studies, whether we know that touch can affect brain structures and hormonal levels and etc. So if you can just talk about, kind of help this presentation legitimize and remind people that touch is within the standard of care and indeed is one of the most highly effective way to increase therapeutic alliance, as well as dealing with issues of trauma, anxiety, depression, reduce aggressiveness, and many other goals of psychotherapy.
Right. And there is, within this course, there is an article specifically about touch and the ethics of touch. And of course, you have whole courses on that, right? You've done a lot of work in this area, trying to get people to recognize the value of touch and stop demonizing it. There's the variety in terms of how much touch is used in somatic psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to ask you too. Yeah. How much is a hands-on within? So first, kind of, if we need to talk a little bit about, make sure that people understand that touch and somatic psychotherapy are legitimate clinical psychotherapeutic intervention, not much different than cognitive behavioral or psychoanalytic. So mm-hmm. we need kind of to establish it so people just reduce the fear and yeah. people are open to understand. And I have articles on the standard of care on psychotherapy that in the touch in psychotherapy. So it's not kind of some pie in the sky idea. It is where the laws and where the legality. By the way, some insurance companies try not to cover touch, which is, of course, right. they don't have the right to define the standard of care. So right. it's not too prevalent, but sometimes requires some fight for that. So once we establish that touch and somatic psychotherapy are within the standard of care of psychotherapy and clinical psychology and counseling, social work, etc., now you started kind of bringing up the issue, how much touch, and do all somatic-oriented psychotherapy even use physical touch?
Right, and definitely not all of them do. Eugene Gendlin, who I mentioned earlier, does mm-hmm. focusing, is all about drawing his clients' awareness mm-hmm. to their body, he'll verbally talk them through it, and there's no touch there.
Just consciousness of the body and right. awareness.
Exactly. And some people even, Babette Rothschild, who is one of the people who works on works with trauma. She has a wonderful book on trauma called The Body Remembers. She doesn't use touch at all. It makes sense for her the way she works. She'll just talk her clients through physical processes, and that works for her. And of course, she's often dealing with people who are severely traumatized and maybe have bad responses to touch, so maybe it makes sense for her. On the other hand, Pat Ogden's sensory motor psychotherapy, there's definitely touch. Pat Ogden, for instance, has this wonderful exercise she recommends that I use myself with in my work. We're just having having a client push against your hands. So mm-hmm. the therapist just hold out their hands, and the client pushes against it, and it's just a way of getting the client, traumatized client, to start to feel the strength of their own body and restore mm-hmm. a sense of presence and a sense of strength. And I think exercises like that are extremely valuable, and there's certainly nothing sexual about that. All you're doing is touching hands and pushing on each other. So little things like that are really valuable. Then there are therapists, the Reichians sometimes do a lot of touch. They'll really get in there and mm-hmm. Push into the muscles that are tense so the client can feel where the tensions are. And then again, sometimes a little touch will do that. If a person is having trouble breathing or if they're dissociating, just lightly touching someone's back can help to bring them back into awareness. There are people...
When I was back east, I was working in the area in Boston many years ago. There was an older woman in her 90s, and she would come, and the only thing that she really wished to have in the session for me to hold her, because yeah. she felt so untouchable. The only touch that she received in her life was from the people in the boarding care where she was, mm-hmm. and the medical touch, that all what she got. And so we will sit for 15 minutes, me holding her hand. I could recite the alphabet in Hebrew, and mm-hmm. she wouldn't care, because mm-hmm. she got the entire care, and her body shifted. And I've no doubt if we check her hormone levels and stress level and adrenaline, everything would have changed, because for 45 minutes, I just was holding her hand, sometimes in quiet and sometimes in silence and sometimes talking, but the talking was completely immaterial. She came for once a week for me to hold her hand, and this was her healing, and she would miss it in the world.
That's plainly healing, and I think that that heals really deep traumas. You know, the brain integrates things. I mean, babies integrate things through touch, and deprived of touch, there's all sorts of things that just can't be experience that can't be integrated
by talking. It can be right. It need to be done. However, there be some indications that I would like to hear from you, were people that what kind of client you would not use somatic or hands-on, actually I would say that you, what kind of client you wouldn't touch or you will use more caution?
Well, again, with severe trauma, one has to use caution, and especially if it's a sexual assault trauma. I think as a male therapist, if I were working with a woman with a sexual assault trauma, I would stay away from touch.
At least at the beginning.
At the beginning. Or things like that Rothschild uses, where it's just palms of the hands touching, something, you know.
I know. By the way, we talk about sexual abuse. In my experience, and we have literature and research to support it. Actually, ultimately, my goal, if I, as a male therapist, work with a woman who was sexually traumatized, and of course, I will not touch the first phase of therapy, and even if I ask permission to touch, and she would say yes, I wouldn't take the yes for an answer. Because it depends on her trauma and experience. She may never learn to say no. So we kind of, even when she say yes, I don't move into touching on any form, not even a hand, until her consent is become really authentic. But the goal in some regard is with this woman is to be able to be touched by a male male therapist without sexualizing the relationship. Now, because this is a long-term goal, and not all trauma survivors are signed up for this goal, but in an ideal world, they'll learn the touch can be not sexualized, but it can take a long time, and absolutely there will not be touch in the first part, and when even the woman will say, yes, I will proceed with a lot of caution.
Right. Right. And I had, you know, when I was in my clinical practicum, in my somatic therapy training, I was working at a sliding scale clinic. I had a 21-year-old woman client who was a prostitute, and she had a lot of sexual trauma, and she had zero history of non-sexual relationship with men, from childhood. Every relationship with an older male was sexualized, and she'd been very heavily sexually exploited. And so in that work, you know, I never touched her because it was important to maintain the boundary that I am a man in her life who does not desire touch from her. That's not what I want from her. And we would, she actually had, you know, even there were issues, like it was hard for her to at first to picture to get a sense that it wasn't sexual, even just to be alone in a room with a man had sexual connotations for her. So I actually worked with her outdoors. We went out of the office to work so she wouldn't have that association.
Beautiful. So what we are emphasizing here, that when it comes to touch, it's not yes and no. Of course, sexual touch is always unethical and illegal, needless to say. But when it comes to healing touch, it really depends on the client, the gender of the therapist, the gender of the client, sometimes sexual orientation, the setting that you are working. Is it you're working within a clinic, you're working on a reservation, you're working in a downtown New York City or San Francisco, or in a psychiatric unit? What are the issues, the background of the client, sometimes the background of the therapist? Some therapists are not comfortable with touch to start with.
Yeah.
So we talk about the context of therapy will determine whether you touch or not, when you touch, mm-hmm. or whether you touch, whether even you touch at all.
Right. And I think you raise a great point about the therapist. The therapist has to be comfortable with the touch. It's no good for the client if there's touch going on and the therapist is cringing about it, the client will pick up on that. So the therapist also has to have worked through their own issues about touch.
If they're going to use touch, yeah.
Yeah. And that's one more thing I want to say about touch is that in the somatic psychotherapy program at CIIS that I'm an alumni of, to get into the program, you have to be a certified massage therapist because they want to know that you understand how to touch appropriately.
How interesting. That's a fantastic qualification.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I haven't heard about it. This is wonderful. This is really pre-screening the therapist, so they have a wide range of comfortable, non-sexualized touch.
Exactly. They figure if you can't handle the work of massaging someone, then you shouldn't be in the field. So even though most people in the program, most people did a kind of therapy where they did very little touch, they all had to know. They all had to actually be certified massage therapists. That was the screening.
That's wonderful. It's like almost, it says it all. We want people who can touch, who can heal via touch, even though massage therapy is not psychotherapy. It's a healing touch of its own. Mm-hmm. And you are comfortable with that, working with both genders and without sexualizing the touching relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's really wonderful. I always learn things when I talk to you. We can talk like this for hours probably, and probably we will. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit what you have one course line up and more courses to come up with. Tell us a little bit about the articles and authors that kind of you have selected to include, first of all, in this kind of course that this audio tape will be part of.
Right. So this is the intro course. So any other somatics courses we develop will be built on this. This is sort of an intro to the basic principles. So we're not talking about, we're not going into techniques like, somatic experiencing and sensory motor therapy. That's kind of for more specialized applications. This is really looking at general principles. And the first section is just an introduction to somatics therapies. The first article is an overview of a bunch of the different types of body-centered therapies by Christine Caldwell, who is a wonderful author. Mm-hmm. She's the founder and the chair of the somatic psychology department at Naropa University in Colorado, one of the very few somatic psychology programs in the country, CIIS, JFK, Naropa. Not many others. She's one of the founding people in terms of somatics as an academic field. And she has a wonderful book called "Getting Our Bodies Back," about reclaiming the body, learning to feel the body. So this is just her overview of different approaches. Gives a very basic idea of what some basic principles and basic orientations in somatic psychotherapy are. And I follow that up with an article called "Of Tissue States and Thermostats." And this is a piece that was written by Dr. Ian Grand. And Ian is wonderful. He's a personal mentor of mine. He was the chair of the somatic psych program at CIIS back when I was in the program. Though he stepped down as the chair, he still teaches in the program. Brilliant, brilliant man. He's a direct student of some of the greats in the field: Stanley Kellerman, Alexander Lowen, who was a student of Wilhelm Reich's, developed bioenergetic therapy. This piece of Tissue States and Thermostats really addresses how this idea that the body is, the psyche is organized somatically, and how to look at the body and work with the body based on this idea. I remember, in fact, the whole mind-body split. I had this big aha revelation moment in one of Ian's courses once, because he asked the class to try to come up with an easy definition of sort of what is the basic foundation of somatic psychotherapy. And I said, thought it was very clever. I said the organization of the body mirrors the organization of the psyche. And he said, take it a step further. The organization of the body is the organization of the psyche. They are the same. And that was a big aha moment for me. And that's really the focus of that article, is that premise of overcoming that mind-body dualism. The next section is more about the principles of somatic psychotherapy, and it starts with an article by Don Hanlon Johnson, another person who was a teacher of mine at CIIS. He founded the somatic psychology program at CIIS. He has written some extraordinary books in the field. There's a book by him that's just called Body that I highly recommend.
I know. It's beautiful.
And another one called Body, Spirit, and Democracy, which is about how somatics applies in a broader social sense. A reminder, Wilhelm Reich, for instance, was a big social reformer. He cared a lot about social justice and did a lot of work with the poor and trying to really saw that... the way bodies were treated in the culture reflected a lot about what was happening in the culture in terms of the treatment of people, the treatment of human beings and human freedom. And Don writes about that a lot. He has a real just deep compassion for human beings.
He is such a special person too, Don. I mean, yeah, I was there when he started the program kind of so many years ago.
He's a giant of the band. He's in his 70s now.
I know. I was honored to kind of associate with him for a while when I was teaching at CIS. It was very special.
Yes. Yeah. And I actually have two articles by him in this course. The next article is also by him, the fourth article in the course, called Principles Versus Techniques Toward the Unity of the Somatics Field, where we started by looking at an overview of different styles, different body-centered therapies, but this is where Don talks about, well, let's get down to what are the unifying principles? What unites the field?
Excellent.
And then the last one in that section is addressing touch, as we talked about, The Ethics of Touch by Christine Caldwell again. So it's her take as a somatic therapist on touch, really covering a lot of what you and I talked about here. And I have the last section they call the embodied psyche, and it's about what does it mean? What are the therapeutic implications if we say that the organization of the body is the organization of the psyche and vice versa? And so we have two more pieces by Christine Caldwell. The Body Speaks, which is about reading the body, listening to the body, seeing, understanding a client through what's happening in their body. And the cultural body, which is very important, a very important principle that I think has to be in any intro to somatics course, and it was definitely addressed. Ian Grand addresses this very strongly in his own teaching. Don Johnson addresses it, this idea that the body is shaped culturally, and that it's going to, there are differences.
Yeah, tons of research on that, really. And the most important parts that kind, or not the most important, but such an important part of what we try to convey here, that this is a legitimate, scientifically based, clinically effective way of conducting psychotherapy, of conducting counseling, clinical psychology, social work, psychiatric work. Oh, and yeah. So we kind of... on an attempt to really introduce it to people who grew up with sheer analytic or sheer cognitive behavioral to understand the wealth of knowledge and information that's scientifically based, that's available and ethically solid, is available on this topic, so people can add it to the repertoire, not just working through insight, not just working through behavioral changes, not limiting themselves to cognitive restructuring, but adding the fourth component of the body. And then in our program, we're going to have more courses around spirituality and psychotherapy as well, kind of tied to that. But what you're bringing here is such a missing piece in the healing process in our Western psychology realm of psychotherapy. So this is just really, really special. Then I can imagine the course will also include a wealth of resources as your other course and all our courses include.
Definitely. We'll put in a reading list. There's really some extraordinary writing on this topic, again, by Don Hanlon Johnson and a lot of the pioneers in the field have produced some great writing, and I'll be putting all of that in the course, recommending
further reading and further reading. A lot of links to tons of resources. There's so many of them.
A lot out there.
And you will also help us kind of as you kind of, you are a practitioner and a scientist. So it's kind of the resources will be resources to research base and clinical base resources for people to use as part of their psychotherapy, or at least to keep in the back of the mind so they can be aware of other ways of healing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I think once one starts exploring it, I think the people who take this course, I think once they start exploring, one of those things where once one starts becoming aware of it, it's just, it opens up a whole new world. I think by providing this introduction and by providing some basic reading on the topic, it opens up this whole realm of curiosity and exploration.
Hopefully. Yeah, this is really the hope. And there'll be a whole bunch of courses, and we're going to put them together so people will have to get a certificate too. So there'll be some sense of kind of proof of competence, at least cognitive understanding. Any other words kind of in closure, Nick, that you'd like to do before people ready to purchase a course?
I conclude this course with the final article in the course is called The Marvelous in the Real, and that's another one by Dr. Ian Grand. And that article, it's the longest piece in the course, and I put it there really to sum things up because it addresses what I think is the most important point here, which is why do this work? That it's about, this is about the liberation of the organism, that I think at its somatic psychology. So I think as psychotherapists, psychotherapy in general, but especially somatic psychologists, ideally are very aware that their work is a work of liberation, that this is a work of, that people are bound and restricted by restrictive patterns of thinking, by tensions in the body and ways of carrying themselves, that people are limited by misfortunes of upbringing, fears that get ingrained into people, they're culturally ingrained, or they're ingrained in mishaps in the family, people don't grow up able to access their full potential and their full capacity for action or for pleasure and joy and creativity in life. And this is ultimately a work of liberation and of freeing people up to more of their possibilities.
That's beautiful, Nick. I would like to thank you for joining us again and the incredible contributions that you have to our field. I mean, your course on autism and neurodiversity has been really well received. And here is another cutting edge, which is actually have been with ours for so many, centuries, but cutting edge in terms of Western psychology and really helping people widen the repertoire and understanding of the process of healing and incorporating into the psychotherapy and counseling practices. So thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to more contribution from you in the future.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful talking to you again. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.